You walk through a door and your sense of scale breaks. The ceiling disappears up into the light above you, and then your eyes adjust and you see it. A wing. 320 feet of wing, stretching out in both directions as far as you can comfortably see. 8 engine nacelles hanging from it like punctuation. A hull the size of a building, smooth and pale and enormous. Your brain tries to file it under airplane and fails, because you have no reference for an airplane this large. No photograph has ever prepared you for it. This is the Hughes H-4 Hercules. It lives in McMinnville, Oregon. It has flown exactly once for approximately 1 minute, over 75 years ago, and it still holds the record for the largest wingspan of any aircraft that has ever left the ground. I'm Tail Dragger. This is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. And today we're going to talk about the biggest thing ever built from wood. Let me take you back to 1942, because that's where this airplane begins. The North Atlantic in the early years of the Second World War was a killing ground. German U-boats running in coordinated groups that Admiral Dönitz called wolf packs were finding and sinking Allied freighters and troop transports faster than they could be replaced. In just the first 6 months of 1942, the United States lost more than 400 ships in Atlantic and Gulf of Mexico waters. German submariners had a name for that period. They called it the Happy Time. That should tell you how badly things were going for our side. Britain was being supplied almost entirely by sea. The troops and equipment building up for the eventual return to Europe were moving across the Atlantic on ships, and those ships were being hunted. The escorts helped, aircraft flying convoy cover helped when they had the range to do it, but there was no clean solution to the fundamental problem, which was that crossing the Atlantic Ocean in 1942 meant accepting a real chance that a U-boat would find you and put you on the bottom. Henry Kaiser had an idea. Kaiser was one of the great industrialists of the war years, famous for his Liberty ship production, which was turning out hulls at a rate that genuinely surprised the world. He understood the shipping problem at a gut level, because he was the one being called on to replace the ships being sunk. His idea was a flying boat, not a small one, a flying boat so large it could carry troops and cargo over the U-boats entirely, high above the surface of the Atlantic, beyond the reach of anything beneath the water. The partner Kaiser had in mind was Howard Robard Hughes. Hughes was already a legend by 1942. He had set the world airspeed record in 1935 in an aircraft of his own design. He had flown around the world in 1938 in 91 hours, breaking the previous record by more than half. He had built the Hughes Aircraft Company into a serious engineering operation, and he had a reputation for treating the word impossible as a temporary inconvenience rather than a final answer. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. The contract that came out of the Kaiser and Hughes partnership called for 3 flying boats. The government committed around $150 million, and there was a constraint that shaped every decision that followed. Aluminum was reserved for combat aircraft. Fighters and bombers and transports were being produced by the tens of thousands, and the aluminum supply was spoken for before it left the smelter. If you were going to build the largest flying machine ever conceived, you were going to build it from something else? Hughes and his engineers turned to a process called Duramold. It was birch veneer, multiple layers of it, soaked in resin and pressed under heat and hydraulic pressure into compound curves. The result was a laminate that was genuinely strong for its weight, workable and critically available. Hughes actually found the process technically interesting beyond a wartime necessity. Duramold didn't corrode the way aluminum could. It could be shaped into curves that would have required complex tooling in metal, and skilled woodworkers, unlike aluminum fabricators, were not in short supply. The nickname the press attached to the project was the Spruce Goose. Hughes hated that name from the day it was coined to the day he died. It wasn't made of spruce, it was birch, and calling it a goose felt dismissive of what he was building. But once a name like that gets into the newspapers, you cannot shake it loose. Spruce Goose it became, in print and in the public mind, and there it stayed. Let me give you the numbers because the numbers matter. The wingspan was 320 feet. AB-17 Flying Fortress, the backbone of the American bombing campaign in Europe, had a wingspan of 103 feet. A modern Boeing 737, the most common airliner flying today, is around 115 feet across. The H-4 Hercules was nearly 3 times that. The hull was over 218 feet long. Each propeller blade was 16 feet from root to tip, which means the propellers alone were taller than a single-story house. The airplane was designed to carry 750 fully equipped soldiers or 2 Sherman tanks or 60 tons of cargo at altitudes up to around 20,000 feet at speeds over 150 miles per hour. Building it required infrastructure that didn't exist. Hughes constructed a massive fabrication facility in Culver City, California, and built specialized presses and fixtures just to handle the Duramold production. Hundreds of workers, woodworkers, and aeronautical engineers and mechanics and riggers worked on the airplane through the war years. The sheer number of skilled hands involved was remarkable. During peak construction, workers could walk upright inside the wing structure while it was being built, and then in August of 1945, Japan surrendered. The war was over, and the H-4 Hercules was not finished. The political backlash was swift. Congress began asking hard questions about where the money had gone. $22 million of government funds and nothing to show for it except an unfinished wooden flying boat that no longer had a mission. Senator Owen Brewster of Maine led the investigation. Brewster's interest in Howard Hughes went beyond simple fiscal responsibility. The two men had crossed paths before on matters involving Hughes's airline business, and Hughes believed the senator was using the investigation to settle personal scores as much as to scrutinize the public record. The hearings that summer of 1947 were contentious and widely covered. Hughes was accused of war profiteering, of mismanagement, of wasting the government's money on a fantasy. He sat in that Senate chamber, surrounded by cameras and reporters, and he did something the senators apparently did not expect. He was direct, he was angry, and he made a public pledge that the airplane would fly. He went further and said that if it did not, he would leave this country and never return. Then he went back to California and told his team to get the airplane in the water. The official line was taxi tests, ground handling, engine runs in the harbor, perfectly routine for a large flying boat. The media showed up anyway, because Howard Hughes doing anything in public was a news event. Cameras and reporters lined the shore of Long Beach Harbor on the morning of November 2, 1947. Hughes ran two taxi tests, nothing dramatic. The airplane moved under its own power, the spray coming off the bow, and came to rest. The reporters had their footage and were starting to pack up. And then Hughes lined up for what was announced as the final run of the day. The throttles came forward on all 8 Pratt and Whitney Wasp, major radial engines, 28 cylinders each, putting out around 3,000 horsepower per engine, 24,000 horsepower total. The hull accelerated across the water. The spray came up off the bow, and then the bow rose. And then gently, the whole airplane rose. 70 feet above the water, 1 mile across the harbor, 60 seconds in the air. Howard Hughes set it back down, and every camera on that shoreline had caught it. He had kept his promise. Now here's where it gets interesting. Most people would have declared victory and moved on. The war was over. The contract was closed. The political heat had cooled. You had flown the airplane once and proved the concept. You could have disassembled it, sold the engines, and called it a chapter in aviation history. Hughes would not allow it. He ordered the H-4 preserved, not displayed, preserved, in flight-ready condition. He had a dedicated climate-controlled hangar constructed on Terminal Island in Long Beach. He hired a full-time crew of around 300 people to maintain the airplane. The engines were periodically turned over to keep the seals from drying out. The wood was inspected and treated. The control surfaces were exercised. The systems were tended to as though Hughes might come back someday and want to fly it again. This went on for years, for decades. Hughes was paying for it personally, a significant and ongoing expense, through a period when his own health and stability were declining badly. He became increasingly reclusive. His business life grew more chaotic, but he did not let the airplane go. He never said publicly that he planned to fly it again. He never did fly it again, but he would not let it be dismantled, and he would not let it rot. Hughes died in April of 1976 in the air on a private jet being evacuated from his compound in Acapulco toward Houston. His estate was complicated and contested, and the future of the airplane was uncertain for a period. The H-4 eventually ended up on public display near the Queen Mary in Long Beach, sheltered under a large dome. That arrangement served its purpose, but the dome was not ideal for long-term preservation, and the setting did not do justice to what the airplane was. Delford Smith was the founder of Evergreen International Aviation, an Oregon-based cargo carrier he had built into a substantial operation over the years. Smith believed the H-4 deserved a proper home, a permanent one, with the resources and the space to show the airplane the way it should be shown. In 1992, Evergreen acquired the airplane and began moving it to McMinnville, Oregon.
Moving a 320-foot flying boat overland is not a small project. The H-4 was disassembled, transported in sections by barge up the California coast, and then moved inland to the museum site. Workers reassembled it inside a purpose-built structure, the walls going up around the airplane as it came together. The Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum opened in 2001, and the H-4 has been there ever since. I've been to McMinnville, and I want to tell you what it actually feels like to stand in that building, because photographs genuinely fail at this. When you walk in, you look up at the underside of a wing, and it takes a moment to register that it is in fact a wing. Your brain wants to see a ceiling. It is not a ceiling. It is the underside of a 320-foot wooden wing, and the engine nacelles above you are large enough that you could park a car inside each one. The propeller blades, held stationary, sweep down close enough to the floor that you could reach toward the tips. The hull stretches away from you in both directions, and the scale of it keeps arriving in stages further than you expected and then further still. And then you notice the wood grain. Get close to the hull and you can see the laminate structure under the finish. The individual layers of birch pressed together under heat and pressure decades ago. It looks like craftsmanship. It looks like something built by skilled hands working carefully over a long time, which is exactly what it is. There is a warmth to it that aluminum does not have. You're looking at trees, transformed by an enormous act of will into the largest flying machine that has ever existed. There is a quality to standing next to the H4 that I find genuinely hard to articulate, but I will try. It is the feeling that comes from encountering something that exceeds what you believed was achievable. Something that forces you to update your sense of what a determined person can do when they refuse to accept the word no. Howard Hughes was not a simple man. He was driven and complicated and in his later years deeply troubled, but he looked at a problem and built something that still holds the record more than 75 years later, the largest wingspan that has ever left the ground. That record has not been touched. The biggest airplane flying today, the Antonov An-224, does not reach it. Nothing has reached it. The Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum is in McMinnville, Oregon, about an hour southwest of Portland. The H-4 is the centerpiece, but the broader collection is worth your afternoon. Military aircraft from multiple eras, civilian aviation history going back to the early days, and somewhere on the property a water park built into a decommissioned Boeing 747, because Delford Smith apparently believed that if you were going to build a museum, you should commit, but you go for the H-4. You go to stand under that wing, look up at those 8 engine nacelles, and try to imagine what November 2, 1947 looked like from the shore of Long Beach Harbor. You will almost get there. You need to stand under that wing to close the distance. Sources today come from the Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum's published archives, Aviation History Magazine's coverage of the airplane's construction and sole flight, and the documentary record of the 1947 Senate hearings. More at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger. Keep the shiny side up.